When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
I mean, people forget that the March on Washington was a March on Washington for jobs. I mean, for economics and freedom.
How you doing, Naira?
I mean, I need some therapy this week with you, my friend, and all the folks listening, because I am fascinated by the Elon Muskiness of it all. I mean, I talk about this all the time and maybe beating a dead horse at this point, but to see him exit the White House and say that he wants no responsibility for what happened there. And his excuse is that nobody really listened or understood what he was trying to do, one. And the second excuse is, yeah, the bureaucracy and politics, this is just a lot harder than I thought it would be. I would love a job
where
I can just show up and my performance can be so poor that I miss my targets by multiples of hundreds of percent and then still walk away with billions of dollars and a bunch of contracts that keep all of my personal businesses alive. Like, what a great deal that must be.
It must be a really great deal. And look, at the same time, you know, this guy, Elon Musk, and what they were up to is really undermining the entire thesis of kind of modern American government, like a government we can rely on, a government that's going to show up for people regardless of who you are and where you live and what you look like or anything else. Their entire approach was just to rip the wiring out and just see what happened, see if the machinery still worked. And we found out a lot of it doesn't work. You know, I live now in the Northeast and Newark Airport is having just a hell of a time. Meanwhile, they're cutting the FAA budgets, cutting the transportation department. We don't have enough air traffic controllers. We don't have like all the equipment where it's supposed to be. I think this is a great a horrible symbol of what happens when you really don't care about government and you just let the whole thing fall apart.
And we've talked about this. It's part of the design, right? The lack of belief that federal government should exist, should provide a uniform set of services to the majority of Americans. Like, no, either you are a laborer earning money or for somebody who's a capitalist, but they don't really necessarily want a middle class or anything in between. And that this, the great social experiment that was coming out of the Great Depression, that was about having a secure middle class, having secure retirement. It was recognizing that humans are more than just the labor that we give. And Elon Musk is from a type of people who believe that humans are commodities. It's a direct translation to his family experience in apartheid, right? Like it all is so glaringly obvious, yet somehow we still allowed it to happen. And this is my question for you, Jamal. Is Elon Musk exiting now smart because, as he said, he doesn't want any responsibility for the work and what he's unleashed, and now it just goes back to Trump and we start focusing back on that? Or were we better off when the genius that is Elon Musk was still there?
Well, I think it's going to be better off politically for it to go back to Trump, right? Because the reality is Trump's going to be on the ballot as the kind of driving force in the next midterm election in 2026. People are going to vote to support Donald Trump or not. And I think Elon Musk was operating a bit as a heat shield from Donald Trump, because everybody was so mad at Elon, was so upset about what they were doing at the Doge factory with all the kids, Big Balls and his friends who were over there and like ripping up the government, that they weren't really talking about Donald Trump being the one who instigated it all, let it happen, and was profiting from it all. And literally, here's what we know now. Trump is literally profiting from the government, right? Like, he not only is doing crypto balls and having all of his friends come and show up, but the more interesting report from last week was the one ABC did that talked about how when we were all focused on Donald Trump releasing the Chisleys or Chesleys, however you say their name, the reality show couple that he pardoned last week, or Larry Hoover, the gang member from Chicago that he pardoned last week. Meanwhile, Donald Trump was letting his business associates off the hook, whether it was pardons or Justice Department dropping cases against people who he had financial relationships with at the same time. So we're all fixated on the reality show aspect of the Trump presidency, while meanwhile, these guys are cutting deals for themselves and their friends, letting people off the hook and cutting people like Elon Musk into some big contracts. And we're not talking about that.
Oh, and it's so apparent. Trump literally said in one of the pardon memos that it was because the mother of one of these people donated $1 million to his campaign, right? So the pay to play is right now actually an official government record. You can't tell us don't believe what you see anymore. And I think about this, if that is where we are, and that is until Democrats get a majority and hopefully the agenda and message to check it, because even right now, I'm like, I don't understand necessarily what it means when leader Hakeem Jeffries says we will respond at a place and time of our choosing. I'm like, that wasn't yesterday. Okay, that's going to happen maybe after 2020. Okay, I'm trying to understand that. But until then, it really is up to us and in our communities. And part of that is, how do we engage? If we want to push back on this version of capitalism, then we should certainly do the protest and unionizing that form of capitalism too. The Target boycotts, they seem to be working.
Yeah, look, the Target boycotts that have to happen, there are people, and that happened with Reverend Jamal Bryant from Atlanta. He has been really leading that effort along with a bunch of others. Look, paying attention to what's happening economically is incredibly important. And the truth is that there are business people who do see Americans and workers as commodities. And there are people who think the only way you're going to actually build up your business is to have good workers and have good customers and be able to have a responsible business that can grow and do that. And so there's a tension that exists always in the American economy between people who are trying to build the country up from the bottom up, or as Joe Biden would say, from the middle out. Then there are those who say this is really about getting a bunch of money into the hands of the wealthiest people, like Howard Lutnick, who's the Commerce Secretary, who believes we ought to go back to kind of the Gilded Age era, that 1870 to 1910 kind of time, where the richest people in the country got the most and they all got together and decided what was the best way to spend it. And everybody else hopefully would benefit in some sort of way from what these rich people decided. But what we know from the 1980s and various other experiments is that's not the way that it works. It doesn't work the way that you're going to have a bunch of rich people make a bunch of money and everybody else is going to benefit. That's just not the way it trickles down. All right, joining us now is my friend Rick Wade, who's joining us from Washington, D.C. Rick is here. He's got a big day job over at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but he's a South Carolina guy. And you may have read about Rick recently because he was just down in South Carolina for a big weekend that Congressman Jim Clyburn and the state party held. And Rick held an event at his home with Maryland Governor Wes Moore. And with Wes Moore, he talked about black business and economics and a bunch of stuff I want to get into with Rick, because I wanted him to be here. Because on Trailblazers, we want to talk about people who are challenging the status quo and thinking about what to do next. And one of the things that Rick is focused on is thinking about civil rights organizations, how we talk to African-Americans, and whether or not we're spending enough time talking about economics as much as we are talking about social issues and all the things that have been sort of animated the civil rights movement over the course of the last six decades. So anyway, welcome Rick Wade to Trailblaze.
Hey, well, thank you for having me, man. Good to see you. Good to see you
yeah.
again.
It's good to be with you. So, Rick, I just want to talk a little bit. You're from South Carolina. You have done all the things, right? You've worked in state government. You've run for office down there. You worked for Barack Obama in the Commerce Department. What have you learned in your years in politics down there that you think are important for us to know during this era?
You know, man, listen, the one thing I've learned over the years, it really is about the economy. Here's why I say that. So even though most of my adult life was in Columbia, South Carolina capital, I grew up in a very small rural textile town, Lancaster, South Carolina. We know you're not there if you call it Lancaster, but it's like, but back in the day when I grew up, Springs Industries, textiles was the mainstay of the economy. And, you know, you fast forward, the textile industry is gone. And one of the things that I witnessed over the years is that when that industry left, crime went up, social issues increased. Springs Industry, that local textile company, was sort of the fabric that held the community together. There was even this area called The Hill. The Hill was sort of our version of Black Wall Street. It's where there were Black businesses, doctor's office, lawyer's office. There was a fresh seafood market, even the barbershops. They all convened in what we call their own Black Wall Street. The reason I say that is I have always believed that, you know, one of the most important issues that I think as elected officials, as government and industry, that we can do to create an above and sustain an above ground economy is focus on business and how we create jobs and entrepreneurship and understand the importance of business and industry is a really important fabric of our society. So I say that that's one thing I've learned. During my political career, as you mentioned, being chief of staff of Lieutenant Governor, working in the House of Representatives of South Carolina, running statewide for Secretary of State back in 2002, and then being one of the early advisors and architects of President Obama's first campaign. So that's a lesson learned. And I think from the last election, I hope we got the message that it is about the economy. It's about the economy.
So when I think about Black business, you know, we can overemphasize capitalism and whether or not you can really kind of grow your way out of this with just an economic focus on people growing businesses and entrepreneurship. But, you know, some of the more recent numbers out of the SBA are that, you know, there were about 3.5 million African-American businesses, and those businesses hired 1.2 million employees. One thing that we know is Black-owned businesses hire more African-Americans, women-owned businesses hire more women, Latino-owned businesses hire more Latinos. So if you care about Black unemployment, and I think the most recent statistics say Black unemployment is at about 6.3% in the country, while white unemployment is at about 3.8% in the country. So we see that there's still this big gap between white and Black unemployment. So if we want to deal with Black unemployment, maybe having more Black-owned businesses is a way of getting at that number.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I would also say that we have to start looking at Black-owned businesses, and you're right, the 3 million, as very important contributors to America's economy. That's the first thing we have to start doing. So it's not just about, you know, Black businesses hiring Black people, but it's about how Black businesses create jobs. It is the importance of how Black businesses are important anchors in those communities. As I mentioned, my community of Lancaster in Columbia in D.C. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I looked at the Black business owner as my role model, and which is why mm-hmm. I became an entrepreneur. So when you think about sort of the ripple effect of strengthening the Black businesses in America, you know, and we know the data is very clear. You know, the value of Black and other minority businesses in supply chains. Quite frankly, they are more productive and they're innovative and they bring cost savings to companies and corporate supply chains. So there's a whole business case for investing in and growing and supporting not only Black-owned businesses, but small businesses in general across America.
So, you know, Rick, I think a lot about what's happening with Black men in particular. And we saw this in the Trump election, the last Trump election. Trump got about 22% of African-American men, double-digit growth over where he was in 2020. And I look at these Pew numbers. Pew had a number that said 1 out of 5 Black adults say owning a business is essential to their idea of success. And I just wonder if you think, are Democrats talking enough about kind of the success agenda? Or are Democrats leaving that up to the Republicans and that's why Trump is having some headway? I mean, how do you figure out what's happening in the kind of political economy around this question of Black success?
But I think you're absolutely right. I have never understood it. As long as I've been, you know, Democrat, probably since I was born, even though, you know, I consider myself a pro-business Democrat, I never understood why we sort of concede the business agenda, if you will. And I think I think it's a missed opportunity. I think you're right. When it comes to Black men in particular, to your question, it's really interesting to me as I travel across America, why, whatever the data suggests, whether you believe it or not, why some sort of like President Trump. And I think part of that is because of what he represents in business and wealth and capitalism. And I think it's a misnomer, or we miss the opportunity to think that we don't want wealth, that we don't want business, that we don't want free enterprise. And I think we have to embrace that, because I would argue at the end of the day, it is about the economy. It's about how do we create better jobs? Yes. But the other pathway to wealth is business and ownership, which we lack. And you think about those numbers of 3 million Black-owned companies, most of us are sole proprietors. Now, how do we grow those? How do we scale Black businesses? And I think, I would argue that, you know, we're missing an opportunity to tap in oftentimes what I call disaffected Black men. And Jamal, I'll be honest with you. I feel like some days I'm one of those when it comes to the Democratic message. And because it's about economy.
Why do you feel that way? Why do you feel that way sometimes?
Well, because I think, you know, we've not changed with the changing times. I mean, I remember when civil rights leaders, when even my my mother and grandparents, back in the day when, political leaders would come to the house and bring the sample ballots, and the expectation is that you vote that sample ballot. Those days are over. I mean, for good reason and legitimacy, you know, Black people in general asking tough questions. What's your agenda?
Yeah.
You know, not just on criminal justice, not just on education, not just on SNAP, but what's your agenda to make my life better? And to me, that making my life better is economic. How are you going to help me improve my economic well-being? So I think our approach, our strategy, how we engage, what our message is today in 2025, it just has to be vastly different than it was in the 1970s and 1980s. It's just the reality. There's an awakening that I see across America, particularly with young Black men and young Democrats who are asking these tough questions. And I think for good reason.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
From a meeting at the office to a big first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
So, you know, this is a debate that's been going on in the African-American community since the end of slavery, really, right? Because you think about Booker T. Washington, who in 1895 gave that big Atlanta Compromise speech. He talked about operating like separate fingers of the hand when it came to things political, but economically being like a fist in terms of African-Americans and their white counterparts. And then you had the rise of W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP in the 19-teens. And they were really talking about, you know, social rights and how do we make sure that we're going to have education and voting and those questions, which are real questions. But we've had this tension, right, that's existed, whether it was Malcolm X and the sort of Nation of Islam and, you know, and Black business and entrepreneurship in the 60s versus, you know, Martin Luther King and the SNCC guy or SCLC. This is a tension that's existed for a long time in the African-American community. And do you think that that tension ought to exist? Is that something that it really is a contest between these two different wings, or is there a way to kind of fuse together these two different ideas of economic and social rights together?
Well, I guess if you want to call it a tension, it's actually is a good tension. It's sort of a duality of who we are. It's both. And I think there is a way for both to coexist. I mean, we can't deny that for the era, and I'm older than you, I think, that I grew up in, I mean, civil rights, we had no rights. So
right.
It had to be a civil rights agenda. But let's be clear also, even with Dr. King, I mean, people forget that the March on Washington was a March on Washington for jobs, mm-hmm. I mean, for economics and freedom. So I don't think that's unusual that you had Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. I mean, that's the reality. I think the question is, in 2025, that, you know, we're falling a bit behind on the economic agenda. But they have to coexist. Because I think we're realizing even today that, you know, even voting rights and civil rights is not something that is necessarily guaranteed that we can't take for granted. So you have to walk both of these paths together. But I do believe that we need to invest a little bit more time in focusing on the economic agenda. It's civil rights and silver rights. It's both.
I like that. So I don't want to get too much into your day job, but you are at the U.S. Chamber. And a lot of people think of the chamber as being a Republican place. So how do you kind of rectify or square that up when you go into communities that may not look at the chamber as being an ally necessarily for some of the work it is that they want to do?
It's the most exciting work I live. And let me be clear, this is not unusual for me to sort of be the only one. Because, listen, I mean, the reality is you don't change institutions and change the dialogue unless you're in the game. And So I'm 8 years now as in this 113-year-old, we just celebrated our birthday of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the highest ranking Black executive. I take that with pride because the work that I've done to bring more of us into the chamber. And you know this, particularly at the policy table, you know, we have to do this work. Whether it's in, you know, international trade or tax reform or regulations, AI, this is where the table is set. So it's extremely important that we are involved with the chamber, not just the U.S. chamber, but the thousands of state and local chambers. So I work every day to try to reset the table, to make it more inclusive, to make sure that we are at the policy. And that's what we do best. We set policy. We're advocates for free enterprise. We're advocates. We have American chambers in 130 countries around the world. Very rarely, let me say that. I mean, growing up in South Carolina, when politicians come to the church, when they come to our institutions, they didn't talk about China. They didn't talk about tariffs. They didn't talk about real access to capital. Nobody talked about the fact that 1-2% of venture capital goes to Black businesses. So this is the knowledge that I try to impart as I move around the country and getting us at the table. So I think that's really important that we are engaged at the chamber or in business and private sector in general so that we can be a part of setting the table so that we can eat, right? And we can have a part of the piece of economic pie.
So now here we are, I guess, 4 or 5, 6 months into the 5 months into the Trump administration. And we've seen Elon Musk, kind of the business guys, come in and try to run the government for the last few months. How do you interpret what's happened with Trump? Is there anything happening there you think is good? Are there things happening there that you think we have to kind of push back on? And what does that mean for politics in the Black community when you have really a business-led government? Does that make people scared of having more business involved in government, or should they just move on to a different question?
Well, I mean, go back to America's history. Where has business not been involved in government? Government not been involved in business? This is nothing new. We may disagree with the approach. I mean, you go back to the founding of our country and slavery. I mean it's all been business and government.
Right. You could say the government was really founded by planters and shopkeepers, right? Who farmers and shopkeepers who wanted to keep more money. That was the whole point of the revolution.
Capitalism. I mean, laws are made and business is done. I mean, that's the fabric of how business is done, not just the United States, but around the world. So we may disagree with, which we have our disagreements even at the chamber with President Trump on issues like tariffs. The effect that has particularly on small businesses. That's why we sent a letter to President Trump and administration for an exclusion of small businesses, because there are more small businesses that depend on importing than people think. I mean, it's an extremely important part. And that those margins are very thin when, you have tariffs. So we may disagree with the approach of the president on issues like that. But, having come from corporate America myself, I do think, there are certain lessons that government could benefit from the private sector, and there are certain lessons the private sector can benefit from government. So we may disagree with the approach of Elon Musk and Doge, but there are some efficiencies, of course. I helped to run the Department of Commerce during the Obama administration. And we brought some efficiencies to the U.S. Department of Commerce, same with state level, state government. I ran a state agency cabinet of Governor Jim Hodges back in the late 90s and tried to bring some efficiencies in how we do business as government. So there are things that we can do better. There's no question.
But all right, so let me ask you this.
That the end goal is often different than profit. It's about people.
Yeah. Let me ask you this before I let you go. Can we talk about South Carolina? You were down there last week. You were down there last week, and a bunch of, Tim Walz down there, the governor of Minnesota, former Democratic nominee for vice president, as well as Governor Westmore. Obviously, South Carolina is the pivotal, early state for people who want to run for president. How do you think people down there are thinking about the 2028 presidential election? Is it too early? Or, we saw some candidates down there last week. Should people jump in? Should everybody show up down there? What's going on?
Well, listen, I can tell you that that it's never too early. I mean, obviously, there will be a presidential election. I can tell you that the forum that I created was a conversation with a governor. It wasn't so much about Westmore as a candidate, whether he will run. I think he's made it clear he doesn't intend to run. But I convened business leaders and other stakeholders around the very conversation that we're having now. And, one of the things that, again, I'm trying to do is set the table around issues related to economic opportunity, business, the very issues that you and I just talked about. And it was very successful. And so what I can tell you is, based on what I saw, the interest, the excitement, the enthusiasm about this conversation, I believe is going to be paramount and really critical that anyone who comes to South Carolina needs to talk about, how do we improve the economic well-being of South Carolinians, and particularly Black South Carolinians, as you know, who make up the majority of the primary when we get to that point. So I wasn't there for, who's running for president. I was there to drive and start a conversation. And I'm doing that with Republicans and Democrats here at the chamber around advancing what we call a growth agenda that's good for all of us, and certainly good for African Americans.
All right, Rick Wade, I want to thank you for joining us on Trailblaze. We'll see what happens when these candidates get out there and when the Democratic Party finally puts out some sort of agenda. If they have an economic agenda that addresses, this unemployment and business ownership. I think the last number I saw, 3% of businesses in the United States are owned by African Americans. We got to get that number. If you've got 13% of the country is Black, but only 3% of the businesses, that's a big number for us to close. So let's see if we can do something about it.
Well, we will. And thank you for having me, man. It's good to see you.
I'm back, and I was thinking about something Rick said about South Carolina. I'm really glad you asked that question, because it's been such a different dynamic in the last two election cycles, now that South Carolina is further up the list of primaries. And Joe Biden would not have been president had it not been for the South Carolina primary, right? And so you have, we heard the name, Congressman Jim Clyburn. And in this conversation about generational change and all these older leaders who need to step aside, we also can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Jim Clyburn was a civil rights leader, and as the dean of the caucus, but also somebody who actively pushed to make sure that the Democratic Party recognized the power of Black voters, and that was included in the primary process. Otherwise, what, like Iowa, New Hampshire? We're not talking the most diverse states. But that, right, like that dynamic of like what type of leadership does that still bring forward? Is it enough to have Black voters participate, or do you need a diverse set of Black voters participating earlier in the cycle, right? South Carolina voters are not necessarily known as urban, young, you know, it's a very different voting population there. And I'm curious about what you think when it comes to that generational change conversation.
Yeah, there needs to be generational change. I think we have to do it with some, like you said, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, a lot of people like Bernie Sanders. He's like the oldest guy ever, other than Donald Trump and Joe Biden. He's like the next oldest person, you know, out there in politics. But people really like what Bernie stands for. And so the question is, are you open to new ideas? And are you trying to empower, you know, younger people, people with different ideas? And are you just taking on whatever the status quo and the challenges in the moment?
Like, do Bernie travels around
to fight for them.
Bernie travels around with AOC, and he's been very strategic about traveling around, spreading that economic change message with younger people from his own party. And we don't see that from everybody else.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think if we're talking about, you know, a place like South Carolina, it's more Southern, it's a little more conservative, right? Because Southern African-Americans are a little bit more like their, you know, white Southern counterparts. They're more religious, they're more business focused. That is true. But there also are people who are younger who are fighting for like kind of maybe some more progressive change, if we want to use that word for it, because they live in a different economy. And I think for people who are a little older, sometimes it's harder to think about the fact that the economy has changed so much. So the idea of going out and buying a house and having, you know, and letting that grow over the course of 30 or 40 years, that's something that's pretty far away from people. Or the idea of, you know, oh, I'm just going to borrow a few thousand dollars to go to college and then, you know, I'll pay that back later. No, people are borrowing tens of thousands of dollars to go to college, and then you got to get a job where you could pay that number back, you know, sooner. And so the first rungs of the ladder are getting further and further apart, and it's harder and harder for people to climb those ladders. And so they're going to need more help in order to do it. And if they slip, they're going to need you know, a little bit more of a safety net to catch them when that happens. And we haven't even started talking about artificial intelligence yet and what that's going to do to jobs and security and how people approach their work. So there's so much that's changing in the economy that we've got to be much more creative than we have been over the last decades.
And that's the idea of moving past just participation. It's like, all right, it's great. I also was part of a, at that point, what was known as the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And I have learned that just because you're present and participating doesn't necessarily mean that the policies are reflecting you, right? I'm just aware of it and aware of how the sausage is made to have the policies reflect our generation, right? Which is a generation that had student loans, can't even fathom the idea of college being free. We're the first generation that is not going to be able to out-earn our parents, yet we will be working more hours. So it's not a laziness factor. It's the gig economy, no social safety net, no corporate safety net. And then right. you hear things like, oh, Target, after losing millions of dollars and brand value, is deciding to double down on its, well, we're not going to have any internal DEI practices by now, taking off the Black businesses on their shelves. I'm like, Black makeup brands and beauty brands were huge. And it was such a great thing to see that in a place like Target. I'm like, oh, okay. So your reaction to community making themselves heard in that very capitalist way, which is the market wants something, you refuse to offer it, we're going to move on, is to retaliate by hurting the people that 3 years ago, they were all about bringing into the systems, you know, all about helping them. So that economic, almost old school liberal argument, I'm like, well, where do we go from there?
Yeah, well, where we go is where I think a lot of people are starting to go, which is, you know, you go online. I mean, the thing about the economy now is if you want to buy something, you can pretty much buy it almost directly from the person who makes it, or people are creating their own microsites, right? So some of these churches are having Black-owned business fairs where you can come in and buy things from either local business people or national business people, or people are creating websites where you can go and find the brands that you care about that will no longer be at Target. You can find them on Instagram and other places. So people are trying to create these workarounds. But the problem here is that the market has changed. And it's not just African Americans who are buying these products. You know, a lot of people who are white are buying things that African Americans make as well. As well as obviously people who are from different backgrounds of color.
No, I'm going to tell you, any woman of any ethnicity who has curly hair absolutely wants to use Black hair products. Like, right? Like, that is an experience that only the women with curly and rough hair would understand.
I will sign off and agree with you because I don't know any different, because why would I? Although I will tell you, now I'm the father of a daughter, right, who's 5 years old, and I have a patented ponytail that I can do. Everything else is basically like, you don't really want daddy messing around with all that stuff. But I can do a ponytail and I can put some clips in there, and then we can roll out, we can get going for the day. But I do recognize the value of a good product.
Mm-hmm. And that's the direct-to-consumer argument. That is also an argument that right. says we don't need institutions that used to service our parents and our grandparents. We're going to, right, that direct communication and direct access is ultimately in the spirit of what the union movements, the progressive movements, all worker and consumer movements have wanted. But then the Democratic Party also is an institution that needs to evolve and adapt to that idea of direct to consumer, direct to people engagement. I'm curious to see how much overlap there is when we have the, you know, Trump parade, his triumph as if he was a Roman general going down Pennsylvania Avenue in tanks on June 14th to celebrate his birthday. Not even a holiday that is an American holiday, but Trump's birthday.
Right.
He will get a military parade and then also have to pay money to fix the streets that parade messes up. That, like, the response to that is community activation. There'd be people are protesting in rural communities, they're protesting in cities. I don't know that the Democratic Party is, as a, you know, functional party, is embracing that vision of change or embracing that type of communication.
Well, it's got to. And look at what's happening in states. I mean, I think that's the other place where we have to be focused, because there are Democratic governors of states. There are Democratic mayors and communities, and they are able to then organize things in their states that will also go after. I mean, some of the great legal victories that have occurred over the course of the last few months have been because Democratic secretaries of state have banded together and sued the Trump administration to get some of these horrible actions ruled on by courts. Now, the question is, will the Trump administration abide by any of these rulings? Or, you know, it was, you know, great reporting about this, that what the administration is doing is not appealing some cases because they don't actually really want the appeals to go up to the Supreme Court, to the Supreme Court, where they could lose nationwide. So they say, oh, we lost this particular case in this jurisdiction. Let's just confine it to that jurisdiction and do whatever else we want to do other places. So they're being really, I guess the generous way to call it would be creative, but it's dastardly, right? In the way that they are thinking about how do they govern the country without judicial oversight and without listening to the people. that's what's happening in the American government.
Well, the judicial oversight, we're still waiting for that, right? Waiting for that accountability. Nice to see that the trade court last week said that Trump can't move forward with some of his tariffs. Like, you can't just randomly say to a country, until we're done with negotiations, we're going to slap on 50%. That's legally wrong. It's also a violation of constitutional powers. It totally ignores Congress, which, you know, the current Republican Party is happy to cede power to Trump. But it's nice to see that in that economic framework, the courts did stand up. Trump having a total meltdown, yelling about the Federalist Society, which literally gave him the Supreme Court and every Republican on the bench, right? Like, that was a multi-year effort to also get rid of Roe v. Wade. And now, because of one ruling, because these are more old school traditional economists, did not like what Trump's policy is, now he's against the Federalist Society. So it is, those are the moments where I see the dastardly plan fall apart, because it won't work with the cult of personality. Those are trying to have a system of rules and governance while having a cult of personality does not work.
That's right. Someone, I think we talked to him in an earlier conversation, you and I, Dr. Hassan Jeffries,
yes,
who is Hakeem Jeffries' brother. But one of the things that Hassan Jeffries talks about is that Donald Trump is one of the first presidents who's not been governed by party or principle, right? Or patriotism. That those are usually the three things that will guide a president. You can count on them. They have a patriotic vision. They have a party confine. They care about their party succeeding, or they care about some principle they're trying to uphold. This is a president who doesn't care about any of those things. All he cares about is profit, right? And so for him, everything is about profit. And even the way he conducts policy, like going to Ukraine and saying, give me minimal rights and I'll give you more weapons to defend against Russia, like, it's all about personal profit. And, you know, maybe profit for the country in some way, but I bet you there's always like a little deal in there for the Don and Eric Trump to come in right behind the government policy and try to open up, you know, Trump Tower Kyiv. I'm sure that's on the docket.
I like the three P's, right? Power. Excuse me. What did it say? It was not governed
was
by party.
Party, principle. Right. Party, principle, or patriotism.
Right. Because I actually don't want to be governed by party either until the parties figure themselves out. Because, you know, one party, the Republican Party, is not at all recognizable from what people grew up with in the 80s. It's a Trump party. So then you take all these other weird conglomeration of ideas based around principles that now somehow are everybody else. And I don't see the Democratic Party having evolved to adapt to that dynamic. But principle, I'm down with being governed by a set of principles that applies to all of us. We have to apply that community by community and, you know, hope that enough people turn out and help people turn out to at least change the balance of power in 2026, which I can't believe we're already talking about another election.
Here we go. Naira, it was good to spend some time with you again this week.
Thank you, Jamal. We'll see you all next time.